And sort of like the Beatles, we've gone through those changes with him. And he spent 50 years, think about that, 50 years making us laugh. And more importantly, in some people's opinion, he spent 50 years making us think. Would you welcome, please, Mr. George Carlin.
Thank you. Thanks very much.
Thanks for coming.
Sure.
It's your first visit to XM, right?
Yes, it is. Is this okay, distance and everything?
Sure.
Good.
You look pretty good for an old fart.
Well, first time I've done makeup for radio. Old fart is...
I forgot. You're not an old fart. You're...
An old fuck.
Yeah, right.
I'm an old fuck. Kind of like a fat fuck, tall fuck, the skinny fuck, short fuck, you know. It's not old man. Old man is kind of like not an age or a period of your life. Old man is a point of view, you know? It's a way of looking at the world. There are some guys who are old men in their 20s and 30s. You've seen them. Yeah. You know, they just got old mannish ways. Sometimes you see a little kid with, glasses and a double-breasted suit, and he's like a little old man, you know? So it's not old man. It's not old fart, which is kind of like... It's old fuck, you know. In this respect, fuck is a synonym for the word fellow.
Well, you look pretty good for an old fellow.
Well, I feel pretty good for a 69-year-old guy. Yep.
You're going to be celebrating 70 next month?
That's right. May. Yep.
Wow. 70 years old. Now, 50 years in show business, when I was doing some research, I thought, how often do you speak to somebody who's worked with Ed Sullivan and Keanu Reeves? That's quite a... Yeah. Who's more fun, by the way?
Keanu is really fun on the set with Alex Winter. I was in Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure with the two of them. And then the sequel, Bill and Ted's Bogus Journey.
Right.
They were a lot of fun. They're very strange. But, you know... They would never calm down until they call for action on a shot. They would clown and kid around and play grab ass and everything right up until the last second, and then it would be like and action, and suddenly they would be in the scene. And it threw me because I was trying to be an actor. You know, I was trying to be serious about what I had to do.
Right.
And I'd have to just stand there and kind of like keep my mind on my first line, you know, because I'm not a trained actor. And
talk about your movie career, and we're going to invite
people.
Such
as it is.
Yes. Invite people up for questions throughout this whole thing.
Good.
But I do want to go back to what started this whole thing.
Right.
You were born in New York.
That started it.
Now, you.
Is his collar okay? Oh, his collar straight.
Looks great.
I'm kind of fussy about the collar.
Your mother made a rather important decision when you were just a baby to
raise my dad.
Yeah.
Yeah. He was a drinker, and he was a very successful advertising salesman in newspapers, selling space, and he was an accomplished public speaker, after dinner speaker they called him. And he was a drinker and a bit of a bully. He never did beat her or touch her or anything like that, but he kind of terrorized her and was abusive to my brother. So she didn't want that happening to me. And when I was 2 months old and my brother was 5 years old, she took us out the fire escape window in her father's apartment in New York. I in her arms and my brother at her hand, down the fire escape into the backyard, through the backyards out to Broadway and into my uncle's Packard, and drove us off to the country, and she never looked back. Then she got back into business and advertising and raised two boys during the last half of the recession, the depression, the Great Depression, and the Second World War. So she did quite a job.
Your mom's been quite an influence on you, hasn't she?
Yeah, well, she was the sole parent, of course, and... she was absent because she had to work. So I did a lot of parenting to myself. I engaged in a lot of mental activity to kind of fill the void, which children will do, and I had radio to listen to. But she was very conscious of language, as was her father. Her father, a New York City policeman, my grandpa, whom I never knew. I never knew any of the grandparents. I never knew my father either. I had the one parent in my experience. And my grandfather was a cop in New York 20 years, around, you know, back, way back, because they were all rather old when their kids were born. So as a result, this was in the 1890s. And he wrote out, my grandfather wrote out many of the works of Shakespeare longhand during his lifetime because of the joy it gave him. That was the explanation he had. Wow. So that's an indication of the language gene at work. And my mother inherited that. The Irish have that to a great degree. Some do, some don't. But it's kind of a generalization, but it's true. It's an Irish trait, language. And gift of gab. My father had it, my mother had it. So it was natural for me to have that, and then she reinforced it. These things have to be reinforced as well, and she reinforced it in me.
Now, your brother, Patrick, was 5 years older than you.
Patrick, yes.
Usually, when you have a brother 5 years older, you usually become the punching bag.
I know.
How did
he was
handle
too busy out getting laid and fighting and drinking. He didn't want to bother with that. He didn't have time for bullying, and it's not in his nature, really. You know what he told me? He said, when you came home from the hospital, and you know about how a young child can react to a new baby in the house. There are kind of certain horror stories you hear about how tough it is for the kid to adjust to that, and sometimes this hostility. He said, I was so glad when you came home from the hospital. He says, I was so curious about you, and I used to watch you in the crib, you know. And he has a wonderful, wonderful nature, but he inherited, I think, also my father's temper. So he was more of a fighter than I was. In the neighborhood, he was a physical guy, you know, in the bars and on the street corners. But I wasn't really of that type.
You, in fact, used one of Patrick's jokes last night on stage.
Yeah, he's a great guy. He's still alive, of course, up in Woodstock. He said something that I wrote down a long time ago, and I just started saying it recently. He said, what we should do is take all the mentally defective people in this country and give them government jobs and just sit back and watch things improve. He's a pretty funny guy and very verbal, very, very verbal. More so than I, even, I think.
You and him have a sort of the same perspective on things, don't you?
Pat and I?
Yeah.
We both feel it's... you know, we're both opposed to organized religion. We're both opposed to, you know, the way government had, the way the citizens have organized themselves in this country, which passes for government. I think the Republic is a failure. We both, for the most part, think this experiment was nice while it lasted, and we're not too impressed with the human species because, you know, the record is rather... rather not a good one. And so we inhabit the same area in those kind of philosophical areas, and we talk a lot on the phone a couple of times a week, and we have, you see what we have, I'm 69 years old now, he's 75, and we have common memories, we have common experiences and nomenclature and things in our childhood that I can call him up and mention a brand name that is no longer in existence, like Ipana toothpaste. Right. I can call up and I can say, Tepat, Ipana. He'll say, yeah, wow, you know. it's so great. We're both world over Irish. There's another generalization. The Irish are very kind of sentimental and like that, you know. And there's a nostalgia that we love. And we're both a bug for those artifacts of our childhood. And it's just nice to have that. So common vocabulary, common background, common memories, you know.
Do you remember, by the way, the spokesperson for Ipana? on television?
I can be reminded, no.
Bucky Beaver.
I didn't know that. I did not know that. Really? On television? No, no, no. We're radio kids. Right. I mean, we experienced television when we came home from the street corner, but we didn't hang on the television set after school the way the next generation did. We were radio kids, and then as fast as we could get out of the house, we were street corner guys.
Speaking of street corner, you hung around Morningside Heights.
Morningside Heights.
But you had a different name for it.
Well, they called it Morningside Heights, Columbia University, because of political reasons of their own. We lived in what we called White Harlem. It was the west side of Harlem. It was technically, in a manner of speaking, the white area of West Harlem. We had Cuban, Puerto Rican, a lot of Dominican, great number of Dominicans in Manhattan now, and black Harlem, of course. So we lived in a kind of a mixed area, especially as you got out from the Irish enclave. We lived in a little, I would call it an Irish enclave. And as you went out from there, actually on LaSalle Street, at one time at LaSalle Street, one half of that street was white and the other half of it was black. And there wasn't a lot of hostility. I mean, there were occasional things, and there were attitudes probably that people held privately. I don't know. I didn't never have that in my household. I never had those words and those attitudes expressed. So I didn't have them. But I know I heard the kids around me. But there was never any open hostility, because when you live in the area between two very different areas, you have to learn to get along. It's a luxury to live in the middle of one of those areas and have all these attitudes and, you know, have a chip on your shoulder. But when you live right where the two of them join, you're forced to sort of live in a third area, which is the mixture. Right. And it's very nice. It's very it's a good way to start your life.
Well, the people in that area, your childhood, certainly impressed you. You shared them with all of us. Father Rivera. Was he really that lenient? You could actually see the line move at confession?
Yeah, Father, we had about six priests in the parish. Father Kelly, Father Ford was the pastor, Father Russell, Father Smith, and some of them came and went, and I don't remember the names, Father Daly and Father Halperin and Father Rivera, who was there primarily because there was starting to be more of a Spanish representation. I don't use words like Latino and Hispanic. I say what we grew up with, the Spanish people, you know, Spanish heritage. Somewhere in their mixed blood, there's Spain. So I call them Spanish people. Father Rivera was there to serve them and to pastor them, or I should say, to tend to their pastoral needs. And one of them was confession. And Father Rivera didn't understand. I mean, he understood English, but he didn't sound like he understood English. and we would go to Father Rivera because he was notoriously, or that's probably not the right word, he was famously more lenient. And you would get a lighter sentence, a lighter penance in confession.
Sentence.
And you could see people would switch the line, people on Father Kelly's line, when Father Rivera would show up and, you know, they kiss the stole and put it on and go in the confessional, you would see people race and rush over to Father Rivera's line. Father Rivera, you know, I say three Hail Mary. He didn't question you. Some of the priests, you know, they would question, so how did you touch yourself? How did you touch yourself, son? He didn't go into any of that, how I touched myself.
No, you just started.
You know, he didn't want it that.
You just started doing a voice. You used to sit around the tape recorder and record these voices, didn't you?
Well, this was a turning point in my life, and it's one that people should know about. When I was a young boy, I was a mimic, and I could imitate people in the neighborhood, authority figures, teachers, shop owners, other parents, cops on the beat, and people on television. Yeah, I could do little imitations. They were largely imitations of other people doing imitations. That's how you learn to do Jimmy Cagney. You see another guy do it on stage and you say, oh, okay, and you copy him. It's easier because they point out the highlights of speech. But neighborhood stuff. I was kind of the class clown in school. And then after school, I was kind of like the neighborhood wise guy, one of the neighborhood wise guys on the street corner. And I would gather a little audience because I would put together little routines. I had little parodies that I did I lifted things. Everyone steals from comedians when they're starting. So I would steal imitations in Humphrey Bogart and Jimmy Cagney and Peter Lorre, and I would do fake commercials that I had heard or read in Mad. Well, Mad Comics came along a little bit later. There was another magazine called Thousand Jokes. And I put together little routines, and they would say, Georgie, hey, Georgie, do that thing about such, and I would stand up and do it, and it would come out differently each time. And I developed this ability to stand up in front of a group of people and get their attention and get their approval. That was important to me, apparently. When I was a little kid, I'd go to my mother's office, and she'd say, imitate Mae West, do the imitations. And I would do the imitations for the ladies in her office, and they would laugh. And I noticed, I don't remember noticing this per se, but I must have noticed that this got me the attention of adults. Because don't forget, I was alone in that house most of the day. When I wasn't in school, I came home and I was alone. I got the attention of these adults, and I got their approval. Through their laughter, they were more or less saying, good boy, George, good going, way to go. Yes, he's good. He's cute. Ain't I cute? Ain't I clever? That's what this job is. So as a youngster, I wanted to be a comedian. I was probably only 8 or 9 or 10 years old when I began to form an idea that I wanted to be in the movies like Danny Kaye and like Red Skelton. And I called that being an actor, but it was actually being a comedian. And pretty soon I found out the word comedian, and I wanted to be a comedian. And when I graduated from eighth grade, the last thing I graduated from, by the way, my mother asked me what I wanted, and one of the brothers at school, Brother Conrad, had told us that he can get a clergyman's discount on cameras. So I asked him if he could get a clergyman's discount on tape recorders. Now, this was 5 years after the Second World War. Tape recorders had come out as consumer items, but they were as big as a small Buick. They were large. They were like this big, and you had to buy them in a showroom up above the street. They weren't on sale in stores. I bought this big Webcor, long story, and I'm keeping it long, that I used it. I used it to do voices and do little sketches and skits and fake radio shows and fake newscasts and commercials. And I used it to more or less train myself for the thing I wanted to do. My mother was very progressive to have bought me that as a graduation present. I mean, she was a far thinker to see that in me and go ahead and foster that and reward that, even though she didn't want me to follow it, but she knew it was a healthy thing for me to be doing.
You've always been a planner.
Yeah,
you
yeah.
had this optimistic
plans, they call
this optimistic attitude that if you planned it well enough and you meant well, it's going to happen. You believe that?
Well, I would only plan things I felt, you know, that obviously that I wanted and thought I was qualified for. But this is the good example. This career planning. When I was a kid, I said, "Well, first I'll be." I wanted to be an actor. I called it actor because I saw them in the movies and I knew they were movie actors. So Danny Kaye and these guys, I thought actor. Okay, so first I'll be a stand-up comedian. And don't forget, when I was a kid, the only place stand-up comedians worked was nightclubs.
Right.
Those kind of really more or less sophisticated places where you saw in the movies, you know, and people danced and there was a singer. And there was a comic. And I never got into those places. I was too young, and it wasn't in my world. So I knew about comedians from radio and from television later, but movies when I was a youngster. So I aimed at that, and I thought, well, the way to get there would be to first get into radio. That would be my first move, because then I could practice using my voice and I could learn to speak and do a lot of these things without an audience directly in front of me, which is the usual thing in radio. They're not sitting in the studio. And therefore, I wouldn't be as nervous or afraid, and I could kind of build up my confidence, and then I could become a stand-up comedian, because by then there were further venues for comedians. I thought, then I can be a stand-up comedian, and then I can go, then if I'm really good at that, then they have to let me in the movies. And that was the way I looked at it. They had to let me in the movies. And that was the plan, and it became more sophisticated as I went through 13, 14, 15 years and started to actually think of ways to go about it.
Now, you actually revealed your life's plan in, what, were you 11 years old?
When I was 11, was fifth grade, Sister Nina, and I saw her, by the way, just about 3 or 4 years ago. She came to a show
really
of mine up in Wisconsin. Yeah, she was 81, sharp as can be, sharp, thin, quick. You know, she said, "Yeah, you lived on the top of the hill." You know, they remembered me for other reasons, but she actually remembered that I lived right up the block from the school. Fifth grade, Sister Nina, I used to sing at the club meeting. They had once a week, they'd have a club meeting, and there'd be new business and old business and all that kind of stuff. And then there'd be the entertainment. You could do an imitation, you could bring in your banjo, play the piano, sing a song. I would always stand up and sing a song. I sang Mañana in her class. Mañana, mañana, mañana is soon enough for me. And, you know, some of the guys thought it was goofy and some of them liked it. But Sister Nina's class, we were assigned to write an autobiography. I think fifth grade is about time to look back on your life. So part of the autobiography was the last page, and that page was what I'm going to be. And I said, I want to be either an actor, announcer, disc jockey, imitator, I guess I called it, or an actor. Actor, comedian, imitator, announcer, or something like that. So there it was, you know, right in front of everyone. And there was a nice amalgam. You can tell that the thing I wanted most was attention. That was really what that sentence was all about, you know. Ain't I cute? Ain't I clever? Look at me.
Well, you went to the Army. You got that out of the
Air Force, yeah.
Air Force, right. I'm sorry. And luckily, there was a radio station.
Yeah.
Just off base.
Yeah.
It was in Shreveport, right?
Shreveport, Louisiana, which sounds like a kind of a dopey place for this. Actually, it was a very hot radio market. They had 9 radio stations at that time, and it was very competitive. And Top 40 radio was just beginning, and rock and roll was just beginning, because Elvis Presley's first hit came out in 1955 or 56. And there I was, right on the cusp of all of that. And I wanted to be this announcer, disc jockey guy, when I got out of the Air Force. My plan was to go in the Air Force, do 4 years from 17 to 21, get out at the age of 21, and use the GI Bill to go to school to learn to be an announcer and a disc jockey, so that I would be learning when I was 21. Now, I got in there, and when I was 18, I was in an amateur play downtown in Shreveport, in a very good community theater company, by the way, Shreveport Little Theater. And I was doing a play called Golden Boy, and in it was Joe Monroe. And Joe Monroe was famous as a radio personality in Shreveport. I was out on the base. I was in the Air Force out on the base. And in my off time, I would do this play. And Joe was a famous radio personality. He did the morning show. He did the afternoon drive time. And I didn't know he owned the station. But so it was a really great station, KJO, KJOE in
that
Shreveport.
That wasn't the clue?
Yeah. Well, you know, there was a slight inkling in my mind, but I didn't know that he was the outright owner. Actually, he was 51%. That station was number one in a 9-station market, in spite of the fact that it was a daytime-only station. They had to come on the air every morning again at sunrise, turn the transmitter on, and gain back all the listeners who had tuned out at sundown. There are some stations of low power. This was a thousand watts, and daytime only, but it was number one, and it had about a 50% share of the market.
And this is what...
We're 9 stations competing with 8 other stations. They had 50% of the listeners, yeah.
I was going to say, this is what it sounded like if you lived in Shreveport. Alex,
oh, yeah.
You want to roll that?
Keep getting my show.
Yeah,
Solid, how you doing? Lots of music coming up for you between now and 5:45. Got the brand new Everly Brothers record, and we'll be playing both sides of it for you. In addition to listening to Elvis's latest, came out this week, and we'll get things started with the new one by Chuck Berry. Stick around, good things happening here on 1480 at Carlin's Corner.
Yeah, Yeah.
You didn't even chalk up the whole bed.
No, I didn't use it up. I liked when the brass came back in. I used to let the brass come back in to build. Those
Carlin's
are great jingles.
Corner.
Listen to that band, huh? Pretty good band.
Yeah, well, if you went to the next market, the same band with a different set of...
That's right. Yeah, the jingles were done in Dallas. It was a big jingle mill.
So there you were on the radio. Now, was that the first time that you really got that feeling that of not power, really, but, hey, I'm reaching people that don't know me, or I don't know
them?
Yeah,
well, surely. Yeah, I mean, just by definition, of course. But the way the mechanics of the thing happened, I was in this play, and Joe Monroe was in it, so I said to Joe, I said, hey, Joe, I wonder if I could come down and watch you do your radio show, because I'm going to be a disc jockey when I get out of the Air Force. And that was my first step, being on the radio. So I didn't bother telling about comedian and all that. I'm going to be a disc jockey, and I'd like to watch your show and pick up some tips and see how you do it. He said, yeah. He says, come on down. I still didn't know he was the owner. I got there and watched his show, and he went off the air at sundown. Let's say it was 6:15 that night. It changes. It gets later and later as the summer goes on. And when the show was over and the station was off the air, he said, go on in the control room there. I'll stay here at the board. Go in the control room there and the announcer's booth room and read these. Read some of this news copy and read a couple of these local commercials. So I brought him in there and I read them in my best, you know, assumed announcer voice. I was 18. I still had my New York, I guess. Well, I had a non-regional accent that I had been kind of... cultivating since I had the tape recorder, but it wasn't perfect. I still had some New York vowels that gave me away. But I read for him, and he liked it well enough that he gave me a job on the spot, starting me at, it was 60 cents an hour, which he knew, well, he knew cheap labor when he saw it. 60 cents, but I forgot, I was in the Air Force. I was eating free and sleeping free and getting a little money too. So it was fine with me. I would have worked free, obviously. The job was weekends only, Saturday and Sunday, and 5-minute newscast. We had 5 minutes of news every hour, you know, 55 music, 5 minutes of news. Reading the newscast, the ones that were not sponsored. The sustaining newscast. It was either for the U.S. bonds or join the Navy or some kind of, you know, drive carefully, those kind of things. So I learned the weekends reading those newscasts, how to read on the air and everything. And pretty soon I got a noontime spot where they played nicer music. It wasn't top 40. They played kind of like nice music. Joe was a musician, actually. So that's how it all began for me. And I saved all that time. When I got out of the Air Force, and I got kicked out a year early.
I was going to say, you keep saying when I got out of the Air Force, but the fact is, you were kicked out of 3 high schools.
That's right.
Kicked out of choir, kicked out of summer camp.
Altar Boys, summer camp.
Altar Boys.
And Boy Scouts.
And
that's called... Yeah, that's...
And the Air Force.
That's called the hat trick.
Now, what was the terminology of the Air Force used?
Yeah, the Air Force discharge? That was it was a general discharge under honorable conditions. It wasn't a BCD, a bad conduct, and it wasn't a dishonorable. So I got all my pay and allowances. But they let me out early because they were looking to cut manpower, and they looked in the areas of people who were being less productive than others. And I was in a very elite maintenance squadron. We had to have the highest IQs going into the Air Force of anyone to get into K-systems. We ran and maintained the bomb navigation system. They were analog computers and radar systems and optics. We repaired them, and that was a very advanced system made by a lot of different... It was in the Boeing 747, which was the medium bomber. And I got out of the maintenance area. Once I got the job in the Air Force, they thought, well, that's pretty good. We got a guy. They were doing kind of public relations for the base. You know, this is good for the Air Force base to have a guy who's being productive and not just knocking up local girls, you know. So I got out of my career field, as they call it. And because I was not productive in their minds. And so I could get out 11 months early. And I got out at 20. And at 20, I had my GI Bill of Rights, and I had 3 years' experience in the field I wanted, and I had beat the game.
Very good.
Yes. It was a good start. It was a great start. It let me know that, man, you can make some breaks for yourself.
And the next stop was KXOL, and you met Fort Worth.
Right? I met Jack Burns in Boston on radio up there, but I wasn't suited for that station. It was a network station with soap operas and stuff, and I went up there because you always want to get to a bigger market. When you're in radio, the first thing you do is you start recording your voice. You start taping to make your tape. You start making your audition tape so you can get to a bigger market. There's more money, more exposures. You can move on. It's a farm system, you know? So I wanted to get to Boston. I thought, well, I'll go to that station. I had a friend who got me in there. The guy was in the sales department. And I figured, well, I can make a base there, and I can look around Boston for a top 40 station to go to. But it never worked out. But I met Jack Burns there. We roomed together with a third guy, Ron, and hit it off very well comedically. And I lost that job. I got kicked out of there for taking the news unit, the mobile news unit, from Boston to New York on the weekend just to buy some grass. Right. That was what I did. So, you know, once the twig is bent, you know, so grows the tree. And there I was.
Wait a minute. You didn't go there because the pot was so good in New York. You didn't know anybody in Boston, right?
I didn't know anybody in Boston, and I wanted to be with my buddies down in New York.
Right.
So we were five of us driving all through Harlem looking for grass because we knew where to go. 135th Street was the stop. We had certain stops we could make to buy grass. And we're driving around in this thing with, it says on the outside, it says WEZE, NBC News, you know. And we're looking for grass, and we're all like guys, you know, in our early 20s. So it was a lot of fun. But got fired from there, was out of a job for a while, and then I got called down to Fort Worth, where another guy from radio in Shreveport had moved on, a sales director, and he wanted me for their station in Fort Worth, so he brought me down there. So number one station, I got the homework shift, 7 to midnight, answered my own phones, took all my own requests and dedications, and suddenly one day Jack Burns showed up from Boston. He says, I'm going out to give Hollywood one last chance at me. That was his attitude, which is the way to look at things. And his tires were bald, so luckily a news job had opened that day, and he got that job, and he was my nighttime newsman. And you know the rest. We went down to an after-hours comedy joint, which was really a coffee house called The Cellar in Fort Worth, and we did impromptu sketches every night, impromptu skits and two-man stuff. And it was so successful, we left radio. We said, screw this. You know, we had great jobs. We were making like $300, $400 a week. It's 1960, and we're in Fort Worth, a good market, and we could have gone on from there, but we decided to quit radio because we'll go to Hollywood and become stars. Because we have this filthy act that we did. Filthy. It was just, and in those days, filthy comedy didn't have a market for it at all. And there we were, how naive, but how wonderful when you're in that age period, to just get in my newly bought Dodge Dart Pioneer with the tinted windows and the AM/FM radio, and drive to Los Angeles on spec, you know, on speculation. We had about $300, and we got lucky out there. I got lucky every time I turned around.
Well, when you went out there, you got a job at a club.
Yeah, what happened was this. First, we went out there, and we were looking to see how we could get into show business. We knew we had this act we had written, and in the daytime, we'd write stuff and learn, and it was terrible. So we would go to places and look at other people, and we would hang around Dino's on the Strip and figure Frank Sinatra might come in. We hung around the Brown Derby one night, and Rock Hudson came floating through. And we were just using up our money. And one day we went back to the apartment, and the rest of our money had been stolen out of the sock drawer. Good hiding place, George. And we had no money. So we thought, well, gee, we hadn't counted on that. And we had vowed not to work, just to go straight into show business. We didn't want jobs, none of that bellhop stuff, none of that car hop, none of that stuff. We won't go into radio out there. But what happened was the only thing we knew was radio. And the only thing we really felt we deserved was radio. The second biggest market in the country. I mean, it was sheer lunacy to expect to just get into that market. But we went first to KFWB, number one in the market, top 40 station. And they didn't, we didn't have tapes or anything. They didn't want us, you know. So we're walking along, and we see this radio station, KDAY, right near Hollywood and Vine. It's actually Selma and Vine, in between Sunset and Vine and Hollywood and Vine. We walked in there, and that's where my star on the walk is now, out in Hollywood.
Really?
I had them put it out in front of that radio station. It's kind of nice. We went in there, and they were looking for a morning comedy team. I mean, it's just all luck, you know? You just get lucky, and you're on a roll. They were looking for guys like us. We did a tape for them. They loved us. They called us the Wright Brothers instead of by our real names. They called us the Wright Brothers, but it did a big publicity campaign, ads in Variety, full-color ads and everything, and put us on the air. And here we are on the air about, let's see, it would only have been about 2 months after we got there. And it was just sheer madness, you know, there we were.
That wasn't good enough for you.
No, no. What we did was still work on the act. We're going to work on the act because this is only a stepping stone, you know. And now we're making about $500 a week each, you know, and that's good and we're great. But we're practicing this act after hours. This was also a daytime station, by the way. Even though it was a 50,000 watt and it had a big signal out on the West Coast, it was a daytimer. And we went off the air at sundown, and in the studio, we would work on these routines. We were getting serious now. And nearby, about two blocks away, was a coffee house. That was the way for us to get in. They were now coffee houses. It was the era of the beatniks. And coffee houses liked offbeat entertainment. And we knew we could get in there and do our stuff for the owner, maybe, and get a shot. Just get a hootenanny shot. Get a single shot, you know? And we went over there, and he liked us, and he hired us for 2 weeks. And we're still rehearsing our act, and a guy came walking through the studio because it was an office building, and you could see the studios on your left, and there were little offices here. He was a song plugger. He was a guy who used to do PR for songwriters and stuff and record labels. And he saw us, and he used to be the road manager for Rowan and Martin. And he says, I think you guys could make it, you know? So we gave him he became our manager. We went in this little coffee house. They held us over for 6 weeks. Lenny Bruce came in and saw us. Mort Saul came in and saw us. And based on that, Lenny Bruce, we got a contract with GAC, one of the biggest agencies in the country. They had New York offices, Chicago, and Beverly Hills offices. And we got into nightclubs where we quit radio again. We quit. We said, no, sorry about that. We've got something to do. And we went on and began a career that worked out very well. 2 years together, we were on The Tonight Show with Jack Parr that October. We drove out of Shreveport in March. We drove out of Shreveport in March, and that October, we were on NBC television at night on the biggest show for a comedian. It's just stupid, you know. But, man, it can happen. It can happen, you know. Yeah, thank you. Thank you.
I've heard the term luck of the Irish. Maybe yeah. It started with you.
I know it. I think the luck comes from heredity. You know, that's the first draw you get of luck, good luck or bad luck.
Jack Burns, by the way, if you're not old enough to remember, went on to do Burns and Shriver, who you may have seen on Ed Sullivan Show, doing their taxi cab routine.
Jack was the bigot in the back, and Avery was the cab. Yeah, well, you know, these commies out there, the commies, you know. he did that character very beautifully, and he had a good career. And he played Warren when Don Knotts retired from Mayberry RFD, he played Warren. He was the new deputy. And he's had a good career writing and producing things.
Now, you went on to become a solo act.
Yeah. We each of us wanted to eventually become soloists.
Ed Sullivan.
Yeah.
How in the world did that happen?
Well, that's a part of the process as you become known. This was the era of variety television. And there were two important syndicated TV shows at that time, Merv Griffin and had a show. It was a 90-minute nighttime show. And it was syndicated as opposed to being on the network. And so was Mike Douglas. Mike Douglas had a daytime show that was syndicated, both out of Westinghouse Radio, Westinghouse Television. And I did about 15 Merv Griffins, and I did about 15 Mike Douglases. By the time the networks noticed me, the producers for the network, the guy who produced the Jimmy Dean show, they got me on there, and I did a monologue on there, and then they kept me over, and I did another monologue the next week, and there I was on ABC television. And from there, Those same producers did a summertime show the next year. It took Andy Williams' place in the Kraft Summer Music Hall. Andy was on in year round, not year round, but everything except the summer, the TV season.
Right.
And we took his place during the summer, calling it the Summer Music Hall with John Davidson. And I was the house comedian and the writer. And from there, that's when Ed Sullivan notices you, or the Carson people notice you, or Hollywood Palace, or whatever other variety show you were going to get on. There were a lot of variety shows then. Carol Burnett, Jimmy Rogers, a lot of them.
Do you remember meeting Ed Sullivan the first time?
Oh yeah, sure. He was just what he looked like. He was, but he took a. I held out. They wanted me on that show. Here I am, still now in my early developmental stage, although I was on national television a lot. And they wanted me on the Ed Sullivan Show, and I resisted because I had heard that they were very brutal with comedians about cutting their time at the last minute. You have 6 minutes, they come and tell you to cut a minute because the monkeys went long, Sorry, but the baboon went long, you're going to have to cut. So I didn't want that because I did set pieces. I didn't do a series of jokes that I could cut five of them out to take out a minute. I did a piece that required that I had memorized that was 6 minutes long, and that was it. And you couldn't take out anything. So I didn't want them going around doing that to me. That would usually happen, you have dress rehearsal in the afternoon, and then you would have the broadcast at night, live, 8 o'clock. And it would happen between dress and air, they would tell you to maybe cut a minute. And then between air, when they started at 8, and the time you went on, 8:40 or something maybe, they would come tell you to take out 30 seconds more or something. So it was, I didn't want that. And I was fearful enough doing live television. So I finally gave in, and I wound up doing 11 Ed Sullivan shows. And I wound up really writing some very poor material. My standard really fell off because there you are, you're offered two more Sullivan shots. And the money is great, and the exposure is important, and you want to, do that. So, you go ahead and you write a piece, and it's not quite what it ought to be.
Well, yeah, but I was surprised, going back, listening, you did the hair poem the one time, the one that
that's
Sullivan shot.
Toward the end of the show.
Yeah, the hair poem and the thing about the ecology.
America the Beautiful.
Yeah. I was surprised. Did they give you any flack about that? I mean, did you have to review that?
No, no, it was by then, by then I had my beard, and I had begun to grow my hair, and I had stopped wearing a jacket. It was more of a vest look. It wasn't kind of like street clothes. They were a little nicer, but they were nonetheless a shirt and a vest, And at that point, he always accommodated. They always accommodated the change. Elvis Presley was on there, and the Beatles, and then the Stones, and they always, they still did an opera singer. They still did people juggling plates.
Topo Gigio.
But what I did was, they told me I had a choice between two jokes. At dress rehearsal, I did, among other jokes, I did two jokes that were topical. And one of them was about Governor George Wallace of Alabama, who was running for president and was a racist and a segregationist. And he had a favorite saying. He would always talk about the liberals by referring to the pointy-headed intellectuals. He called them pointy-headed intellectuals up there in Washington. He was a populist. He appealed to a populist kind of a racist thing. He called them, and I said in this routine, I said, talking about George Wallace, I said, you talk about pointy heads. Have you ever seen the sheets those people put over their heads? So that was one joke. That was one joke in the monologue. Another joke in the monologue was about Muhammad Ali. Muhammad Ali was the champ at that time. His name was still Cassius Clay. And he was the champion of the world. And they took away his championship because he wouldn't go to Vietnam. He refused to go. And he was, of course, right to do that, I think. Now, what I said about it was this. They told him, no more, sorry, you can't, no more boxing, because you won't go and do your thing in Vietnam. So I said it this way. I said, Muhammad Ali, his job was beating people up. That was his job, beating people up. They wanted him to go overseas and kill people. And he said, no, I don't want to kill people. I'd rather just beat him up. And they said, all right, well, if you won't go and kill people, we're not going to let you beat them up. they told me between dress and air, they told me, they said, you can have your, this is the oddest censorship I ever experienced. They said, you can have one or two of, one of those jokes or the other, but not both. It was volume rather than, it was the strangest thing. So I obviously chose the Muhammad Ali joke, which is far smarter joke, you know, than the pointy head. And so that was my memory of the last show I did. He went off the air. Actually, I did the second to last Ed Sullivan broadcast, although we didn't know it at the time. We found out later that, you know, when he was canceled.
Now, here we're into the 60s. I'm taking longer than I had planned because you're...
That's okay.
There's so many things. You're into the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
You've been getting high since you were, what, 14?
Yeah, 13.
And you were going through... Sorry.
these things are important. These
that year does make a big difference.
That's right.
But here you are. You're 30 years old. The Summer of Love is going on, 67, 66. Mm-hmm. Everyone who's involved with that is generally about 20 years old. And their parents are 40 years old.
In the nightclubs I was working.
And you're in the middle.
Yeah.
And you're playing to the parents, and you made a decision at that point that you were playing to the wrong audience, basically.
Yeah. Just a small backstory to that. Remember the Danny Kaye dream as a child? I wanted to be like Danny Kaye. So that was what I was pursuing in show business, and that's where I had come to that point on the road to. I found out in the interim on the way that I wasn't such a great actor, and I wasn't going to be in the movies. But I found out I was a pretty good writer of comedy, and that I could probably do that and figure that out for, you know, the rest of my days, and let that be my thing with some movies thrown in, you know. So I got to that period, and I had dropped some mescaline and some acid, as had a lot of my friends, and I hung around with mostly malcontents like myself. All my life I had been, you know, I got kicked out of all those things because I defied authority all the time. I wasn't in step. I was constantly out of step with this society and the authorities in it. And that was my B life. My A life was, I'm going to be like Danny Kaye, which, if you think about it, is a mainstream path. That's something that you do. That's a people pleaser thing. You have to learn to please people and go on and get bigger and bigger audiences and become a famous movie star. And that's how you do it. But I had a B life that I didn't know about, that I didn't realize that this was bifurcated. I had a B life, which was, fuck all these people, you know? Fuck all these people. I don't buy this shit. Now, that person was being kind of like suppressed without my knowing it. I lived it out in my private life. I hung out with musicians, and their hair started to get long, and the music started to change in the 60s, and the music was protest, and I was hearing people who were using their artistic talent to further their ideas and their philosophies. Buffalo Springfield and the Beatles and Bob Dylan and Joan Baez and so forth. And I'm thinking, you know, that's starting to dawn on me that I'm not using my ability to further these thoughts and ideas that I agree with. I have thoughts on that too, and I'm not doing that. I'm entertaining these businessmen and shit in these nightclubs doing people pleaser shit. So I something struck at that time, and it was probably the acid, you know. And I realized that I was in the middle, that these people were in their 40s. I was entertaining the kids in their 20s. Well, kids, not the people in their 20s, were embracing the anti-authority that I had lived. So I said, well, this is where my audience should be. And I wrote a new act. I put in a lot of my thoughts and feelings, and it became autobiographical. That was the first thing that a writer does usually, is to write about himself, even if it's thinly disguised. Mine was open. I talked about being a Catholic, being a school kid, being a New Yorker, and the things that had affected me and that I enjoyed about school and those experiences.
Yeah, but during this awakening of yours,
yeah,
you fell victim, like a lot of us did, to when you're doing drugs and whatnot, it's not always conducive to productivity. And
once you get to something that you can't put down,
right?
You know, I could the beer and the pot, my lifelong buzz was beer and pot. You can put that down. You can regulate that. You can say, okay, well, today I have to do this. So, you know, right. I'll just have about two beers in the morning and smoke a half a joint, and then I'll do that, and then I'll get high. So that's... But But when you get to things like cocaine or any of the other ones we all know, and you get to the addictive drugs, it's a different story. And that's what happened in the early 70s, once I had started my record career.
One of the fallout things that happened as a result was Carson. He sort of distanced himself from you when you're going through this change.
Well, when I went through these changes, my appearance, my hair got longer, my beard grew, and my clothing became closer to the, I guess you'd call it, the hippie ideal, you know? And now some people in show business, some old, the old timer, not old timers, but the old school people, they thought that I was making a very crass decision to, as I heard it from one guy, to cash in on the hippie thing. That was their way of looking at this from the outside. They weren't attuned to the kind of, pot is a value-changing drug. It's a hallucinogen. It's a mild hallucinogen like acid, and it's a value changer. And if you smoke from the time you're 13 to the time you're 30, you have formed certain attitudes. And it just reinforced my malcontent, my outsidership, the feeling of being outside and not belonging. So these people had never had that, so they couldn't see that there might be some integrity in what was happening to me, and they thought, well, he's just trying to cash in, don't worry about it, they'll see you through him, and he'll
he thought you were doing a Bobby Darin with
going to the mountain and coming back, I am different. And it wasn't that. It took 2 years for this change to take place physically, with the growth of the beard and the hair, and I did it on television. There were syndicated shows I was doing by that time. Virginia Graham had a 5-day-a-week show, Della Reese had a 5-day, and so did Steve Allen. And on these shows in this change period, I would explain what it was, that I don't belong in nightclubs. I belong on the colleges. I belong on the campuses. The beard would get longer, the hair would get longer. And by the time 2 years was up, I was there. But in the meantime, regular show business, which I cared very little about, but Johnny Carson was important. That was another platform that I wanted to show my kind of like new self. And they got afraid when they heard about it, because they thought, oh, he's on the acid, and they don't know what you're going to do. And I came in to see Johnny one time, and what happened was my wife had written a press kit that was very kind of telling about my new change, my new direction, what I wanted to do. And I was going to handle myself and just kind of be my own manager. And the press kit, I wrote a very funny thing about why I was wanting to go to the colleges. I want to go to the colleges because you can steal lab equipment and stuff. And it was just a very bizarre letter. And I signed it with my left hand, like a 2-year-old, And so they saw this at Carson, and they thought, this guy's fucking nuts, And they dropped me. I had already done probably 10 or 15 Johnny Carsons, maybe more than that. And they dropped me. And I was a year before they could see this other new self take hold, get some credibility by virtue of the fact that I was working in coffee houses and filling them. And then I did concerts and I filled them. And then they said, oh, okay. And they let me back on.
Yeah, but you made the mistake. Well, I shouldn't say it was a mistake. That's for you to decide. But you got all coked up and ran into Johnny's dressing room?
I asked to see Johnny in his office.
Oh.
I asked to come over because I wanted to present my case. But I was full of coke and I was real speedy, I was Greg Whitman's theater. And probably my legs were going like this, and everything, I don't know. And I had a tie-dye shirt that was really garish and bizarre looking, And that just confirmed what they thought. They thought, oh, my frickin' Christ, look at this, So I had to fight my way out of that by being accepted in the place I said I would be, which was, younger. I'll call it a more youth-oriented culture,
Well, Johnny obviously knows talent because you ended up coming back and hosting. You filled in as guest host. How many times?
I don't know. It must have been 20 times I guest host. I've done 140 of those shows, counting Jay Leno, starting with Jack Parr.
Did you enjoy co-hosting? Was that too straight for you?
I enjoyed the status that it gave me. And the exposure to talk about whatever other things I wanted to talk about. But it wasn't coming. And I was loaded on coke on a lot of those shows that I co-host. I did one show when I was loaded, and David Carradine was one of the guests. All right? And I believe he was on acid that night. I only just say I believe that. I've never asked him. he came out in this one of these, you know, he was in that kind of Far Eastern, that period.
Kung Fu thing.
Yeah, right. Well, this was more like Far Eastern. It was kind of a diaphanous sort of a flowing white garment, you know. And he came out, and he was sitting there on the couch with his legs in the crossed position up on the couch. And I could swear to this day that each time I asked him a question, that he was answering the next one. You know? Yeah. That's how fucked up I was. Yeah. And you do have a list of the questions, so you kind of know what's next, because you do rehearse what you're going to ask. But I don't know how that would be possible, but it seemed like he was doing that. I must try it. I wonder if there's anyone out in eBay land who has an old copy of that for some odd reason. Yeah, I have a lot of old
stuff. Can you imagine Mr. and Mrs. America laying in bed watching?
Yeah.
And you guys are on. By the way, speaking of being coked up, the very first Saturday Night Live, you were the host.
Coked all week.
And did they have to bang on your door and get you to come to rehearsal?
They say they did. it's been said to me. I believe it, because you do get, you know, you do lock all the good bolts and things and shit when you're getting real paranoid, you know. I had great coke too, and I did it all week, and I didn't like what I did on the show, and I was afraid to do sketches. I didn't want it. I told Lauren the first day, I said, don't put me in sketches. I'm not good at that. I really didn't feel very confident about acting ability, and I didn't know sketch acting is different from acting, so I didn't make that accommodation in my mind. So I just said, leave me out of everything, you know, just let me do little spots. Let me do little monologues, 30 seconds, a minute and a half, 2 minutes here, and all through the show. And that's what they did for me. They left me out of the sketches, but I can see myself grinding my teeth on that first broadcast. If you ever see the DVD, watch for the guy grinding his teeth and catching his breath, you know, kind of like, you know, like, you know.
I believe you told me you had a collection of a videotape collection of you over the years showing your hair different lengths and whatnot.
I did. I must have lied. I think what I might have been referring to the fact that you can do that if a person wanted to, they could do that. The Great Recession.
Well, during this time in the 70s, when all this, you were finding yourself and going through these changes, you did a couple of movies. You did Car Wash with Richard Pryor.
Yeah.
And you and Richard had worked together, though, before.
Well, Jack Burns and I broke up 2 years after we formed the act, because he wanted to go to Second City, and I wanted to be a single. I had gotten married in the meantime, and I wanted to be a single and for Brendan and I to have a baby, and I had to get out on my own, and we were in Chicago at the time, and that was the birthplace of Second City, and he was very qualified for improvisational theater, very much more qualified for that. So we split up. We worked that night, we worked 2 weeks at the Living Room with Vic Damone. We made $750 for the team a week, and that was a really good level for us. Great to be working with an act like Vic Damone. He was, if some of you may know or not know, a great singer who Frank Sinatra said had the finest pipes of any male singer, and he had a string of hit records and a lot of things that were really fine work. And Jack and I broke up the night we closed at the living room. We broke up peacefully, and the next night I opened down the street from the living room in the nightclub district at a coffee house called the Gate of Horn. I opened up with Miriam McCabe and Peter, Paul, and Mary, and I was the third act. I was the opening act. And from there, I went on. Jack went on Second City, met Avery there, and that became a story.
Richard Pryor.
Oh, Richard Pryor. Well, that was a period that began then of 2 years of drift. I did not have a partner. I worked out some of the contracts that Burns and I still had pending, places like the Playboy Clubs. I worked them alone, but then I never got renewed. And I didn't have much work. And so I decided in New York, after I was married. My wife is from Dayton. We would stay in Dayton when, you know, when there was no work in the Midwest, and we'd stay in New York at my mother's house when there was no work in the East. And I decided that the only way to do this right was to take a stand. And that, now don't forget, I'm still in my clean suit and tie, short hair period. And I decided if I could get a little place in New York, in the Greenwich Village, where I could work out all the time, like a coffee house, and I could develop myself there and get people to come in, get Merv Griffin to come in and see me, get Carson Show to come in and see me. That's what I need. So I did that. I took a stand. I found a place called the Cafe Ogogo. I spent 2 years there on and off. I could work and go away from there for 2 months. I could come back for a week. I could go away for 2 weeks, come back for 3 days. I could work anything I wanted for, they were sometimes $5 a night, sometimes just a hamburger, sometimes on a weekend, $65 if you were working with Bill Evans or someone like that. So I did that for 2 years, and I got Merv Griffin in, and that's what gave me my start. At the place I'm talking about, the Cafe Ogogo, Richard Pryor was in the same state I was. Richard Pryor was still an unknown comedian who hadn't done any television. And he was doing, he was in his inoffensive era, his inoffensive period. He was in his doing Rumpelstiltskin. He did a little, there was a famous Richard Pryor early piece called Rumpelstiltskin. That's what got him on the Merv Griffin show. He was down there working out. We would smoke some joints up there in the high staircase in the basement of this place, and we would do our bits. Occasionally we'd be on stage together. I don't remember much about that, but the people came in to see Richard Pryor one night from Merv Griffin, and they gave him an interview the next week. So he got his interview. And then I'm still laboring there. And he gets a show from them, and he goes and does the show. Well, by the time he got the show, in between his interview and the show, I had gotten my interview. But then he had his show. So I was one step behind him. So then he got his second show. Then I passed my interview, and I got my first show. So the two of us grew out of that room into this syndicated television exposure, which was nationwide and was always watched by the networks. And that was how the two of us sprung to life.
Well, one of the good things about the 70s, you released those albums that most people hear on XM Comedy all the time. FM and AM, Class Clown, Occupation Fool, yeah. Toledo Window Box.
Yes.
In fact, I believe it was, I don't know if you know, but it was yesterday or this week, is the 25th anniversary of Class Clown. Yeah,
yeah, that's nice to know. Those were four gold albums. I had four gold albums in a row, 72, 3, 4, and 5. And then I had a couple after that weren't gold. That was in what I call the Little David years, Little David Records,
right,
owned by Flip Wilson and his manager, who then became my manager, and I was signed to the label. And that was the thing. You see, you need a way, if you're going to do quote-unquote material that should be uncensored, you know, I hate this designation adult, you know, or X-rated or something, but if you're going to do realistic spoken word art, you need, if you're going to get a mass audience, you need a medium. And the medium at that time was records.
Right.
You certainly couldn't do it on television. That was commercial, and they didn't allow that kind of language or those ideas, if it was just the ideas that were dangerous to them. So I got my mass audience through the records. The records fed the box office at the college concerts. The college concerts fed the record sales, and it went around. Plus, you do some television and talk about both. I'll be in Buffalo, I'll be in Toronto, and I'll be in Niagara Falls. And by the way, FM and AM, but you did it a little more gracefully than that. So the whole thing worked. Then I ran out of record career. You know, you can't be the hot new guy in town forever.
Right.
You can't be the fastest gun, because a faster gun is coming to town in a few years. So my record career began to kind of wane in the 70s, as did the counterculture. The disco came into play, and the people who are the true hippies and the true radicals, they kind of retreated to the hills, and the other ones went and got MBAs and stuff like that. And there I was, sort of not knowing who I was and who I should become, you know, to be true to myself. So I drifted a while, and that's when cable started. That's when HBO started at 75 or 76, and I got on there in 77. And now I've done 13 of them. That's my way of reaching the mass audience.
Right. It was the first one was George Carlin, 77, George Carlin again, 78. Mm-hmm. Carlin at Carnegie Hall, 82, Carlin on Campus, 84,
yep.
Playing with Your Head, 86, What Am I Doing in New Jersey, 1988, Doing It Again, 1990, Jamming in New York was 92, did that 40 Years of Comedy special in 96, Back in Town, You Are All Diseased in 99, Complaints, that got a lot of, Complaints and Grievances in 2001, and Life is Worth Losing in 2005.
Right.
I've been told that... Jammin' in New York was a special one for you.
Well, it was, one of the big turning points, I'm an entertainer because I work in the entertainment circuit, but there's an artist at work too. Not all entertainers are artists. Some are just entertainers, and they kind of experience life, their creative lives in a static way. They get to a certain place, and they kind of stay there. Mm. Other people who have an artistic element or component grow, because artists always grow and go somewhere. Artists are on a journey. They don't know where it is going. They don't know. They don't want to know. They just know there's something else. There's something more. There's more in me. There's more to talk about. There's more to look at. A painter, a composer, they grow. They live. They grow. It's an ongoing thing. So that is true for me as a writer. That's the artistic part of me, is the writer. Well, what am I answering again? I'll get to it. Just help me out.
You were talking about the HBO special.
Yeah, and the changes, right. So the artist goes through phases and changes. And I found my comic voice as a younger person in the coffee houses. I found my comic voice. And then that comic voice lasted until the late 60s, early 70s, when I made that change to the countercultural type material. That was a shift. That was a paradigm shift. And that was a change in voice, the comic voice. And the writer voice. And then in 19, and then through the 70s, I developed that, and then said, then I kind of lost track of what would be next. And then I didn't know. I kind of drifted, and I was grasping. Then in 92, even though I did these HBO shows, and they were plenty good, I like them. I still would stand behind every word of them. But there wasn't a new voice yet. There was just like an improved voice that was ongoing. Mm. In 1992, I discovered silence on the stage. I discovered that you could have long periods of silence. The show I did, Jammin' in New York, had a long, more or less serious piece called The Planet is Fine, The People are Fucked. And it was about the fact that the planet will outlive us. Don't worry about the planet. People who tell you they're worried about the planet are not. They're worried about themselves and their habitat. They want a clean place to live. And that's fine. But don't be talking about how you're going to save the planet. You're not. The planet will outlive you, and it will heal itself. And that piece was very thoughtful and very interesting, and I loved it. But I had to learn that there were times in the show when it was okay not to get laughs. Because one of the jobs I have, besides getting laughs, is to engage the imagination. Just in general, to engage the person's imagination. If I make them laugh along the way, that's part of the deal for me. But I learned then that I had a kind of a more serious writer voice in me. And that's when another shift took place. And the shows that follow, that came in the 90s, are representative of that. There's more of a social commentator in them. There's more of a, if you will, a quote-unquote philosophy beginning to emerge. And that was another important shift for me that is still playing out.
Plus, it was the first live one.
It was the first live one. It was New York City. It was the first one done in New York City for me. I did it at Madison Square Garden, not in the big arena, but in the theater there that holds about 6,500. So it was a big audience. It was live, and it was my hometown. And I was king of that town for a night, It really felt good. I looked out my hotel window that night, and I thought, this is my town. One of those kind of scenes you'd see in a movie, kind of a cheesy scene.
It was sort of an adult version of when your mother's friends used to pat you on the head and go...
Absolutely. Yeah, it was just a graduated version.
I still haven't covered books or movies, but I promise to let people ask questions.
Good,
I'm going on and on.
Questions.
Are there anyone here that wants to step up and have a question? Anybody?
See, it's probably,
they're in awe of you. Okay, great. Just state your name, please. And
Hi, my name is Alan.
Hi, Alan.
First of all, it's very rare that you get to meet somebody that is an idol of, and
thank you.
30 years ago, I was introduced to on that first HBO special that you talked about, and I just thank you for 30 years of
thank you.
Making
that's,
me laugh.
That's very nice.
I'm curious about some of the comics that you've worked with who's the funniest that you look back at and you think, man, that guy is, you knew when you saw him that he was going to be as good as, you know, you've ever seen?
Well, the only one that comes to mind, I'm sure if I searched my memory or if I had a better memory, I'd have other examples. But Louis Black was someone I saw early in his exposure, and I knew this was a unique and strong voice, to say the least. So Louis Black, I love him. I love it, that sort of theatricalized anger. And the things he talks about, he's got a good mind. I like good minds. He's one that I think of. I never hung out with comics. I still don't. I'm a loner. I'm a real kind of loner and an outsider. I never hung out in comedy clubs, and of course I never worked in them, so I didn't need to hang out in them. But it also, I was just never attracted to that, the comic culture, the comedians that we like to hang out together. So I don't have a lot of knowledge. I didn't have a lot of occurrences of being able to see someone early, I'd say that. But Louis Black was one that definitely sprang to mind.
Louis tells a great story how CBS wanted to do a series based on him. And he had to go and audition for the part of himself.
Oh, yeah.
And he didn't get it.
Yeah, that's great.
He said, luckily, it never made the air.
I recall that.
Anyone else? Sure, why not? Don't wait for me to be asked. Just walk up to the microphone.
Oh, wait.
Hi, my name's Chris.
Hi, Chris.
You've had the chance to see the entertainment industry evolve tremendously over your career.
Yeah.
And one thing that's I've heard said, and whether it's true or not, is that if you saw a lot of people who are icons today, such as yourself, if you started today the way the system is set up, you might not get the opportunities. You maybe never would have had the chance to become who you are.
That's right.
Do you think that's a fair assessment, or do you think the entertainment industry in general has improved or just changed or gotten worse over your career?
Well, depending on the individual, that's both true and not true. I would say with user-generated content and the viral quality of the internet, that a person who is self-made, let's use that for a shorthand, a person who wants to be self-made has some avenues that certainly I didn't. But on the other hand, life and the world and show business were simpler then, so it was easier to see where the path ought to be. I mean, there was only one way I was going to get started, and that was to get on a radio station, and in the midst of having that career going, to look around at places where I might have a chance to learn to be a stand-up. You know, there were some nightclubs and there were some coffee houses. So the world and the choices were limited, which was probably good for me. But I think if I had had the same tools genetically and had them reinforced as they were for me in this era, and I had these impulses to show myself off, I think I may have found a way, but God knows how different it may have been. And how much longer it may have taken. It's a much more complicated place. I don't envy, I wouldn't want to come of age at this time, although I see a lot of advantages in it that we didn't have. I see that and I understand that. But I'm very happy that I came of age in the period I did, because you could grab it. You could kind of put your hands on all of it without much effort, you know. And now it's pretty elusive and pretty fragmented.
Now, you mentioned you sort of, I don't give up is the word, but you didn't take the movie idea of being a movie star quite as seriously.
I wasn't an actor.
And you've done movies here and there, and you've done voices and animated films.
Mm-hmm.
You were the Volkswagen bus.
In Cars.
Cars, right.
Fillmore.
Yeah. But recently you did. You played Ben Affleck's dad in Jersey Girl.
Yeah,
that was
I like
a serious role.
Well, that was written for me, and I could show my sweet side, a bit of irascibility. But there was a sweetness to the role. It was a grandfatherly role. It was written on a model of his father, and so it was kind of more suited for who I was at the time. The other thing I'm proud of having done, I did a Hallmark mini-series called Streets of Laredo, which was a continuation of Lonesome Dove, And it was the authentic continuation. There's an ersatz continuation that was kind of bogus, but this was the authentic one. And I did a part of an old scout, and I really felt good about that. And then Prince of Tides, I played the gay neighbor, Eddie, and I was really happy with the way that came out. But I wasn't really born to be an actor. If I had trained all my life, it would have been a different story. If I had learned technique and training, yes, but I didn't have the tools.
Hello, I'm Michael.
Hi, Mike.
Mr. Carlin, we know a lot of your comedy comes from things that really piss you off. What are some of the things that really piss you off that you haven't really talked about on stage lately?
Well, you catch me short because I don't have my computer at hand and I can't go look for a lot of stuff. I'm blessed with some pretty deep files. I don't suffer writer's block, believe me. I this current show I'm doing, I went in there and I dug out the whole 75 minutes all at once during that a week's time, took it all out and began doing the way it was, you know, those 75 minutes from scratch. So I'm very proud of that productivity record. But I think it's not so much what I'm angry about, because anger implies that you have a stake in the outcome, that you care. And I don't really care. I don't. I mean, it comes across as anger, you know. Obviously, there's a heightened kind of intensified theatrical anger that you need to convey these thoughts. But I'm not personally an angry man. I'm not personally angry about these things. I think they're wonderful because I root against the species. I finally came to a realization, and this freed me as a writer. This was part of that transformation in the 90s. I realized I didn't really care about this outcome on this planet. I didn't care what happened to the species. I think this is a species that was given great gifts and had great potential and squandered them. I think this species squandered them. I think it chose poor ways of organizing itself socially and politically. I think it made a wrong turn when it came to buying the okey-doke that the spiritual leaders gave, the high priests. We turned it over to the high priests and the traders. It's commerce and religion that have ruined and spoiled the potential of this species. And in this country, the same two things are true, but this country is writ large, and this country is the leader in the decay of the soul, if you will, just to use that metaphorically. And I just don't care what happens to this country. I don't care. I don't give a fuck. So, and you know what, the only anger there is, and I recognize one in my voice there, you know what that is? It's really a reflection of disappointment and disillusionment and being let down by my species. You know, we had such great possibilities, and they're not being realized. You know, they talk about poets and philosophers, and well, aren't there? Yes, there are. How much influence do they have? None. There are more people writing poetry in America than there are reading it. Imagine that. Well, I guess that's true in a lot of fields, but I think that's the anger. It's a frustration. It's a letdown. You know, it comes from, you know, how could you do it? That's why I usually always use the second person. You know, I talk about the audience and I say, how can you, you know what you did? You know, I don't say, you know what we did here in this country. I say, you know what you people did? I put it on them. It's not my problem. You know, so anyway, that's just a taste of what eats around the edges for me.
And if you don't know, if you want more of George's philosophy, the books, Brain Droppings, Napalm Silly Putty, When Will Jesus Bring the Pork Chops?
Yes.
And sometimes a little brain damage can help was actually originally a promotional item.
It was actually a magazine size item to be sold at concerts, but I didn't. I wanted to put out some material in there. So I threw pictures in too, because you have to have pictures in it. It's kind of a pseudo book, quasi book.
So if you want to know more of the philosophy, he was just spewing.
Some of it is in there, yeah.
Yeah, right. Just read those books, because I would like to end on that note. But there's a couple of other questions. One of them that you don't like to be asked is, have you ever thought about when this is going to end? When you're going to retire?
Oh no, I don't mind being asked that. No, it's like I say, the artist is never satisfied. If you begin to be satisfied, you know, something's wrong with you. If you pardon this highfalutin, you know, terminology, I'm talking about the artist part, you know. Pablo Casals, the great cellist, master of the cello of the last century, one of the outstanding musicians of the last century, he was in his 90s, and he was still doing a few recitals, and he would practice 3 hours a day. He practiced his cello 3 hours a day, and someone said to him at some point, they said, Master Casals, you know, you are a past master. You are the maestro. Why, at your age, do you bother practicing 3 hours a day? And he said, well, I'm beginning to notice some improvement. And that's the answer. I mean, why stop, you know? It, only if nature stops me, if I lose the ability to write or speak, some alteration in plans will be necessary. But I've already imagined, because they do have this for people who are totally paralyzed, that the movement of your eyes, you can look at a keyboard that's projected and you can type by moving your eyes to the letters. And they'll have that perfected by the time I'm paralyzed. I'm assuming that.
Well, to quote George Carlin, art doesn't have a finish line.
No, right, yeah. It's just a race, but against yourself, with no reward, except self, you know, the satisfaction of explaining yourself in some symbolic form, or direct form in my case. Painting is more symbolic.
Would you leave us with what you would put on your gravestone? What's your epitaph supposed to read?
He was here just a minute ago.
George Carlin.
Thank you very much. Thank you all. We'll be right back.